Today we're going to look at Psalm 137, which was part of our reading this past week, if you're following along the reading plan. And Psalm 137, I was reading it probably about 2 weeks ago, and I was like, I'm reading it verse by verse, and I'm like, this is it. This is the one I'm going to preach from this section. And I keep reading it, and it's going great. And then you get to the last couple verses, and things get really awkward really quick. And so I was torn, saying, well, what do I do? Do I still preach Psalm 137 and maybe ignore the last verse or two, or do I just deal with it and pretend like it's not a big deal? And so I decided, with the content of Psalm 137 and where we are in the series, Psalm 137 was it. God basically was telling me, you should preach on 137, and that means I have to also preach on the last couple verses of Psalm 137. I don't just get to get a pass from that. So Psalm 137, if you notice, we did not have the scripture reading for this, and reason being, the last couple verses could make things really weird jumping right into the sermon. So let's start in verse 1. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. There we hung up our lyres on the poplar trees, for our captors there asked us for songs, and our tormentors for rejoicing, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song on foreign soil? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill, or let it wither away. May my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem as my greatest joy. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites said that day at Jerusalem. Destroy it, down to its foundations. Daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction. Happy is the one who pays you back what you have done to us. Blessed is he who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rocks. That's the last verse of that song. You know, we're kind of hoping for, you know, a little uptick at the end of Psalm 137. And it ends on this very dark and disturbing note. In order for us to understand what is God doing, allowing this psalm to end this way in the Bible, we have to understand the context. Just like every other part of the Bible, we should seek to know the context of what this writing was set in and what is the purpose. So, in order to understand that, let us start at the beginning, and that will make the end make a whole lot more sense. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. There we hung up our lyres on the poplar trees because our captors there asked us for songs and our tormentors for rejoicing, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. So verses 1-3 really kind of set the scene. The Israelites are remembering, see the past tense, we sat down and wept. That does not mean that this was not written at some point in captivity, but they are remembering when they first got marched as slaves, as captives, over to Babylon outside of their land. When they get there, they get marched over by the river of Babylon, which is more than likely the Euphrates River and the Tigris Rivers over there as well. They sat down and they wept when they remembered Zion. Now, let's think about the context surrounding Psalm 137. Remember that Psalm 120 through 134 are the songs of ascent, all about the people living outside of the land being drawn back to the mountain of Zion, where they are to worship God and see him in his temple. And so immediately after these psalms comes Psalm 137 that says, I remember when we were taken to Babylon. We sat down and wept when we remembered what Jerusalem used to be. Because at this point, the Babylonians had completely destroyed the land. Everything that they knew about Jerusalem, everything around there, all of their houses, everything was destroyed. Every rock was upturned, and they were marched now to a foreign land as captives. So when they got there, they sat down, they hung up their music, their musical instruments. They said, "We cannot sing praises inside a foreign land." When they get to Babylon, their captors, the guards that were watching them, their bosses, their princes, their people around them would mock them, as I'm sure they mocked every captive they had, saying, "If your land is so great, why don't you sing us a happy song about it?" Knowing full well that they had just destroyed every part of their land. Anything that they thought was good about wherever place they came from is now ash. The only thing that is important and good and glorious is the Babylonian Empire. And so their captors, their slave masters, their prison guards mock them and say, "Sing us a happy song, one of rejoicing about Zion." Now remember, in the ancient world, when a nation defeated another nation, it was saying, "Our God is stronger than your God." And so they know that conquering Israel, that what they thought had happened was that their Babylonian gods had come through for them and they had defeated the God of the Israelites. And so they said, "Yeah, you want to sing a song about the mountain that your temple was on? Oh, by the way, we kind of burned it to the ground." And so the Israelites reply in verses 4-6, maybe not to their captors, but in their head when they keep getting asked, "Sing us a happy song about Jerusalem, about Zion, about your land," knowing full well that they had just destroyed it all. They say this, "How can we sing the Lord's song on foreign soil? How am I going to sing a happy song, one of rejoicing, maybe one of these other psalms, maybe a psalm by David extolling and praising God in his temple when his temple doesn't exist anymore? There was nothing to look forward to. It was completely destroyed and we're now in foreign land. How are we going to bring ourselves to sing praises to God on foreign soil?" And then they say to themselves, "Do not forget about Jerusalem, where God dwelled." It says, "If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem as my greatest joy." See, in verse 4, you can see the emotional response that says, "How can I? How can I sing a joyful song when I'm facing so much sorrow in a foreign land, when I feel as though God has been conquered? How can I sing about him?" But then verses 5 and 6 say, "Let me never forget what God has done and who he is. And if I do, may my entire life come to an end," is basically what 5 and 6 is saying. "Let me not be able to do any work anymore. Let me not be able to talk. Let me not be able to sing anything if I do not remember you and exalt Jerusalem, Zion, as my greatest joy." So there is a call that says, although I have this emotional pain and angst about having to sing a song about God and about Zion in foreign soil, I must, I have to sing about God and what he has done before. So verses 4 through 6 are really more or less going through the conversation in the captives' minds. When their captors say, "Sing us a happy song about Jerusalem," 4 through 6 is how they're thinking in their head. And then verses 7 through 9 is the song that they decide to sing. Now, I'm not sure that they actually sung this while they were in Babylon to their captives. If any of the captives were like me, they probably did, because this is how I would tend to respond. Remember that the Babylonians conquered several nations, that these nations all had different languages. I'm sure that eventually over time there were Babylonian rulers that knew the Hebrew language, but these It's very possible that they sang this in Hebrew, so no one knew what they were saying. And they sang it with a smile on their face, singing joyfully. When the captors asked, "Sing us a happy song about Jerusalem," this is what they decided to sing. And it's very dark. It says, "Remember, Lord, what the Edomites said that day about Jerusalem." And I think they threw Jerusalem in there because the captors asked them for a song about Jerusalem or about Zion, and so they had to throw the word in there somewhere. So they start out with a song about Jerusalem. It says, "Remember, God, what the Edomites said that day at Jerusalem." And Edomites often, aside from being the actual country of Edom, also tend to represent other people groups around Israel that do not follow after God. And so this is kind of a lump sum of all of the people around them. Israel and Edom were never good friends, going back to Jacob and Esau. But they say, "Remember, God, what the Edomites said that day at Jerusalem. Destroy it down to its foundations." So they call God to remember. Remember what the pagan people around us said when Babylon came to destroy us. They cheered. They clapped. They told Babylon, "Take it down, all the way down. Destroy it so it is nothing." And then the second verse of this song is, "Daughter Babylon." So now they're talking about how Babylon is playing in. And it says, "Doomed to destruction. Happy or blessed is the one who pays you back what you have done to us. Blessed is he who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rocks." So you had a Babylonian dinner party. They ask a person, maybe one of the people who sang in the temple, "Hey, sing us a happy song about Jerusalem." And this person says, "You want to hear a song? You want to hear a Jewish song? Here it goes. God saw you cheering when Babylon ripped down Jerusalem. He's not going to forget it. You, because you destroyed the mountain, because you destroyed his temple, are going to be doomed to destruction. Blessed," or God's favor, "is on the one who pays you back what you did to us." Verse 9, I would argue, is a parallel to verse 8. We cannot forget in Psalms that it is poetry. And in Jewish poetry, the rhyming is not in the sounds of the word, as is typical in Western poetry. So we like to rhyme things so that like the last word of every line sounds similar or there's a rhyming scheme. In Jewish poetry, it is the repetition of thought, sometimes changing just one little phrase or one word, and it is to say the same thing twice in a different way, or say the same thing in reverse. So there are different types of parallelism, where sometimes it's one of contrast, one of complementing. I'm not going to go through all of those. But verse 8 says that Babylon will be doomed to destruction, and blessed is the one who pays you back to what you did to us. And verse 9 is saying, blessed and God's favor is on the one who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rocks, to say that the one who pays you back for what you did to us, like you took our kids and smashed them on the rocks. And we hear this and we're appalled. We think this is horrendous. Like, don't let your mind dwell too much on that picture. There's many different difficulties with this passage. Let's first just talk about the picture. See, in ancient times, when nations conquered each other and they led off the people into captivity, it was not unheard of for them to wipe out a generation of children so that then they would not ever remember being part of the land that they originally came from, so that when the captives then were moved to their new land, their children would only ever remember that land. That they would not ever want to go back to whatever land they came from, and that land belonged to Babylon anyway. And so it was not unheard of for the nations to destroy generations of children. It's also documented of these nations that they would do that in a very barbaric way. We hear all this narrative played out in the prophets, that they killed the king's family in front of him, poked out his eyes, put a ring through his nose, and led him on a chain all the way to Babylon. The world in which Israel lived in was not one of civility, not one of good manners. They didn't have the UN, they didn't have NATO, they didn't have any of the Geneva Convention. Okay, I want to make sure I wasn't mixing up church history with world stuff, but the Geneva Convention that tells you how to fight wars. They did whatever they wanted. They pillaged, they burned, they killed at will. And so these Israelites, now in Babylon, having them mock them and say, sing us a song. Sing us a happy song about Jerusalem. So this is what will make us happy. This will be what will make us happy, is when God decides to pay you back to do what you did to us. That will be the day of our rejoicing. Interestingly enough, one of the Psalms, one of the verses from the Psalms, this is the day that the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. It's talking about that kind of a day. When God comes back and overpowers their captors, destroys them in his wrath, and brings his people back. So the picture of this taking babies and throwing them on rocks so they die is horrendous. But this person who wrote this psalm is not just pulling that out of nowhere. This person is not literally saying, whoever takes your kids and smashes them on rocks, God likes. That is not what they are saying here. What they are saying is, you think that you have destroyed us, but there will be a day where you are destroyed by God, and that will be the day of our rejoicing. So now we see that, and we're like, okay, so although it's terribly shocking to us, although it is horrendous to even think that humans were capable of this, we now can see where that picture came from. So let us see it in the broader scheme of things. Again, this person is not just saying, I'm waiting for the day that people come and kill your children. This is an overarching picture. There is a poetic terminology for that, where you take a part that represents the whole. And that is what this person is singing, is saying, I'm looking forward to the day that you get destroyed. And he's taking this small part of what it looks like when a nation gets destroyed to represent the whole. So Psalm 137, seen in its entirety, is really a song for the exiles, or a remembrance of the exile, in the confidence that God actually would return and rescue. Although there are awkward and terrible and grotesque pictures within Psalm 137, the major overarching theme is that even in foreign soil, even when things look bad, when we look destroyed, when God's temple is destroyed, when it looks like God has lost, God will come back, and he will repay the unrighteous, the evil, the unjust, the horrendous acts taken against his children. We see this play out in history. Whether this psalm was written before or after the exile took place, it does not matter, because in history, in the prophets, there were prophecies. So here's the deal. All of Israel now in captivity to Babylon. When God decides the captivity is over, he sends a Persian man named Cyrus to come and conquer Babylon, to destroy it, to completely take it over. This psalm says, blessed, God's favor is upon the one who destroys Babylon. So this song is saying Cyrus has God's favor on him. Because he comes and he destroys Babylon. Babylon is no longer a world power. Now the Israelites are still in captivity, but to Persia instead of Babylon. Babylon was doomed to face destruction based on the biblical principle that pride goeth before a fall and a high spirit. Well, actually, pride goeth before destruction and a high spirit before a fall. See, Babylon mocked the nation's gods. They mocked their captives. They said, nothing can take us. But God decided, when the captivity was over, to send Cyrus to take over Babylon. And it would be Cyrus, as was prophesied, a man named Cyrus would come into power and send the Israelites back. To send them back to Jerusalem. Although it was destroyed, although it was completely ruined, a man named Cyrus would come into power and allow the Israelites to return to the land and to worship God in Jerusalem once again. See, Psalm 137 is a reminder that when God makes a promise, when God gives a prophecy, that God will come through in sometimes the most unlikely fashion. And so for the exiles, verses 5 and 6 say, if I forget you, Jerusalem, let my whole life go to waste. Because they had a hope in God's faithful promises that God would, in fact, return them in his timing. That they did not forget the land from which they came, although the Babylonians did everything they could to get them to forget. They remembered the place where God revealed himself. So Psalm 137 fits great in the overarching theme of Psalm. In book 5, it is all talking about returning from exile back to the land. And although it seems like this is kind of a backwards way to do it, like a flashback, this was written to remind the captives who returned to a destroyed Jerusalem to say, this was the day we were waiting for. We were waiting for someone with God's favor to come and get us out of the captivity from Babylon and send us back home. But what does that mean for us? So let's everybody look up. I'm going to say this very clearly. Don't want you to ever leave and say, I hope someone takes your babies and throws them on rocks. That is nowhere near the application of this psalm. Okay? Clear on that. This is not a justification for us to just say rude and mean and horrendous things at people we dislike. Even if they are tormenting us, even if they are mocking us, even if they are persecuting and or killing us. This psalm is not the justification that you can have to say, I will bring down curses upon you. Because that is obviously not the intent of the person who wrote this psalm. The intent of this person who wrote this psalm was to draw upon the confidence in the fact that God had promised to deliver and to rescue them. But again, how does that really apply for us? We're not captives in America. In fact, we have plenty of freedom to do whatever religion we want. We don't have people holding us in chains and forcing us to do hard labor. We don't have people just beating us for no good reason. So how does this psalm mean anything to us? How can we understand the emotion and the theology behind Psalm 137 when our circumstances are so very different from the original audience? That is a hard and a challenging thing to do in the Bible, but let us never forget that at one point we were captives. We were slaves. We weren't in charge of our lives. We were tormented. And some of you are saying, when did that happen? Before Jesus came to rescue us, we were all slaves to sin. We were all slaves to death. Satan got to tell us whatever he wanted us to do, and we really didn't have a choice. We kind of did whatever our captor told us to do. So if he said, sing us a happy song, we would sing him a happy song. If he said, go and lie about this person, we would just go lie about them. If he said, disrespect your parents, we would just disrespect them. Disobey authority, we would disobey them. See, at one point, we were exiles. We were slaves. We were prisoners. And we did not know about the land that was anything different than where we were put. But see, God made a promise that all of humanity, although doomed to slavery, to sin and death, that he would, in fact, rescue the people that he calls his own. He would send destruction to our captor. He would be destroyed beyond how he destroyed and persecuted us. And so we too live in this awkward moment where, yes, Jesus came. He died on the cross to provide a way of salvation. And in some way, he has destroyed Satan, and yet he is still very active in our world, holding people captive to their sin, preventing them from seeing the truth, getting them to do everything they can to make even our lives miserable. And so when we consider the state we used to be in, where we used to belong to the kingdom of darkness, and we are no longer, and yet there are people around us who are, we can know with confidence that God says, if you call on the name of Jesus, you will be saved. You will be taken out of the kingdom of darkness and brought into the kingdom of light. And then we too, along with this psalmist, can say, blessed, God's favor is on the one who pays you back, Satan, for everything you've ever done to us. Blessed, God's favor is on the one who punishes you like you tried to destroy us. That one is Jesus, who although he came and died on the cross and yet we still see Satan around, one day has promised that there will be a day of God's wrath in which he will come, he will punish Satan and all of those who followed him for their crimes against God's people. In such a fashion that cannot be accomplished, no longer how long you give it. Satan is actually doomed to eternal destruction, one that will never end. To pay him back for exactly what he has done throughout all of history. So, along with verses 5 and 6, let us never forget the land in which God is calling us to live in with him. Let us not forget that this world, this existence we have right now, is not the end. This is not as good as it gets, which is awesome. There is a greater place for us to dwell, and that is where God expects us to dwell with him for all of eternity, with Jesus on the throne, where we can sing the Lord's song, no longer on foreign soil, but in the presence of God himself. Let us pray and expect and wait to see the day when Jesus comes and pays back the kingdom of darkness for everything it has ever tried to accomplish against God's people. Let us call our hearts to take confidence in the fact that God has repeatedly followed this pattern throughout all of history. And at one point, we know, because of who God is and what he has done, that it will take place just as he has promised. And as New Testament believers, we have it even in greater picture, greater detail in the New Testament and in Revelation, what that's going to look like. Let us pick up our instruments, pick up our voices, although sometimes we face great distress. And let us sing songs of a place we have not been yet, of a person that we have not seen yet who has rescued us. Let us sing of eternity without the kingdom of darkness, without sin in our lives anymore. Let us praise God for his faithfulness, for his love that never ends. Because it is nothing that we did to deserve it. It is just by mercy that God sent someone to rescue his people from their captors. It is God's mercy that he sent the perfect person to accomplish that. It is because of his promise that he is always faithful to, even when we are unfaithful to our promises, that we can have the hope and the confidence of an existence in the land of God. It is because of God and his character that we can say, blessed, God's favor is on the one who pays you back, who brings justice for what you have done to us. And that is a rightful thing for us to do. You do not ever have to feel bad in the slightest for saying negative things to Satan. Blessed is Jesus, because he will punish and bring justice to the crimes and the injustices that you have brought into this world.